What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at WeightWatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Katie Halper Show. It's kind of loud where I am, but I wanted to make sure I got out this episode. And it's a great compilation of some interviews I did with people at the People Summit. They're still totally applicable. Make sure you go to patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show, because I'll be posting parts of the interviews that I'm not including in this episode. Also, stand by for some great regular episodes and bonus content. A debate between Dr. Adam Gaffney and journalist Joshua Holland about what to do about healthcare. Some nice left-on-left debate. Zed Jelani talking about being the subject of an Islamophobic smear, and also about the boycott, divest, sanctions movement. And we'll also be talking to Ellie Valley about his great comic book, Diaspora Boy and Israel Man. Also, make sure that you check out my latest piece at pace.com, pinned to the top of my Twitter, about Kamala Harris and about how the response to the criticism of Kamala Harris reveals the disingenuous hypocrisy of the pseudo-woke liberal wing of the Democratic Party, which is fine erasing women and people of color as long as it suits their political interests. Please follow us on SoundCloud, subscribe to us on iTunes, and rate and review us. Thanks. Today I'm playing some really great interviews that I collected when I was at the People Summit in Chicago. The People Summit was a gathering of 4,000 activists, organizers, progressives, politicians. Speakers included Naomi Klein, Van Jones, Ben Jealous, Nina Turner, and Bernie Sanders. First, I talked to Larry Krasner, the Democratic nominee for District Attorney of Philadelphia. Then I talked to Paula Swearingen, who is a West Virginia native, and she's running against Joe Manchin in the U.S. Senate. We also talked to Ginger Jensen, Minneapolis City Council Ward 3 candidate, and a member of Socialist Alternative. Then I talked to Stephen R. Jaffe, Democrat, civil rights attorney, running against Representative Nancy Pelosi in California. Then I talked to Andre Vasquez, executive director of Chicago Progress, chair for Reclaim Chicago North Chapter. So glad to be talking to Larry Krasner, a Democratic candidate for the District Attorney of Philadelphia. He won the primary overwhelmingly, and he's poised to win the DA's race. And he's here. We are live at the People Summit in Chicago. And we just wanted to find out from you what was so exciting and what was so inspiring about your race, your candidacy, that it was able to win in such a landslide.
Well, I hesitate to call myself inspirational, because for 56 years I wasn't. So I don't want to make this too much about me, because I think that would be inaccurate. But I do think that the ideas were clear. They were direct. They were unexpected by some people who are conventional politicians. And I think that was effective. For example, when you tell people that you're not going to seek the death penalty, that causes shockwaves among political professionals who will explain to you why it's terrible. The only problem is they're wrong. It actually worked out just fine, thank you. So we came out with a very direct message, one that I believed in. It had a resonance with a lot of people. And then, because I have not been a politician and because I have been involved for so many years with activists, we had this army, this frankly untapped source of power, which was activists, organizers, people who are probably better politicians than most politicians. They just don't play. Well, they played in this race. And when they played in this race, we had an amazing outcome. We have a ward system in Philadelphia, very controlled by the Democratic Party in theory. In fact, what happened is out of 66 wards, I was only endorsed in 12, but we won 47. In fact, what happened is in a city where in the last 2 4-year election cycles, there have been about 105 or 110,000 total votes that came out. In this election cycle, 150,000 votes came out. That is remarkable for a lot of reasons, because a heck of a lot of votes. But it's also remarkable because Hillary Clinton lost the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania by 40,000 votes. And here in one city in the state, we find this untapped resource of 45,000 votes. It's incredible. It is absolutely incredible. And that is the reason why the Democratic Party in Philadelphia is, I think, both excited and concerned. The Republican Party in Philadelphia is flat out concerned, and it's being noticed both statewide and nationally by both parties. Again, I don't think it's about me. I really don't. I think it's about the reality that this experiment can repeat, that there's this untapped gold mine of activists and organizers who have not played in politics historically, but should start doing it because they're better at politics than the politicians.
What made you become a lawyer in the first place?
Well, I couldn't play professional sports. I couldn't act, and I couldn't play guitar, so I did what I could do. I like to argue with people.
Me too.
You know? So as a consequence, I became a lawyer, and for whatever foolish reason, decided I wanted to do criminal justice. So I did. I was a public defender for 5 years, state and federal court, and then I launched my own little law firm, which defends individuals in criminal court, but also files civil rights lawsuits against often police officers who are involved in brutality or corruption. We've also done some other litigation around disabilities, around sexual harassment of women in the workplace, corrections officers, and so on. But fundamentally, I wanted to do defense of the individual. I wanted to stick up for the underdog, and I wanted to do it in the context of civil rights as a trial attorney. So that's what I did.
There doesn't seem to be as big a tradition of progressives going into the DA's office. I mean, I think of progressive lawyers being defense attorneys. So what made you decide to run for DA, for district attorney?
I spent 30 years watching the criminal justice system go further and further off the rails. I looked around at 56 years of age at the candidates who were in the race, and it was clear that none of them had a background that made their supposedly progressive platforms credible. Many of them I knew personally, and I knew for years, and I saw no sign in the things they had done during their careers that they meant what they were saying about being a kinder and gentler prosecutor. So I just decided it was time. I pushed about as hard as I could from the outside, achieved, frankly, a decent amount from the outside, but I just thought it was time to see if I could get on the inside and make more change.
Did people tell you that you were way too progressive and compassionate to win a primary for this office?
I mean, incessantly, sometimes unkindly. They said a few other things that weren't kind either, mm-hmm. which is the nature of politics. But right. Yes, they did.
And tell us why the death penalty is so important.
Well, put aside the moral arguments for a minute, which I think are compelling. But it's so important because, for example, in Pennsylvania, $1 billion have been spent since the 1970s. And yet no person in Pennsylvania has been executed against his or her will since 1962. All right. There have been 6 exonerations from death row in Pennsylvania during that period. So it is not a good idea to execute people who are innocent. I think we can agree on that. And those
Scalia would disagree. Well, may he rest in hell. That's me, not you.
Scalia would disagree. That is true. So would Attila the Hun.
Right.
They would both disagree. And a few other people whose names we could add, they would disagree. But the reality is $1 billion is the equivalent at $40,000 a year for a young teacher. It's the equivalent of about 500 teachers per year across Pennsylvania for the last 50 years. And instead what we've had is no executions. You know, there is zero evidence that the death penalty reduces crime, but there's plenty of evidence that good public education does. So we've had this basically fraudulent policy that does nothing more than advance cynical politicians to higher office by preying off of hatred and fear. Or we could have good public education like the good public education I had when I was in Pennsylvania schools. We could have good public education rather than the school closings and the massive class sizes that we have now.
So when people who I know who support the death penalty hear about exonerations, they then say, you see, the system works. The people who are innocent are being cleared. We don't have to worry about it. seems like one of the issues is that people don't have the resources when lawyers are trying to defend people who are still on death row. It seems like they don't have the time or resources to go and prove the innocence of someone who has already been executed. Can you talk about that and how?
Sure.
What's your response to people who use the exoneration as an argument that exonerations as an argument that it's a self-correcting system?
I mean, my response is that's an extra super dumb argument for a couple reasons. These exonerations.
Is that a legal term?
Yes, it is. Okay. It's a technical term, and there are hyphens.
Nice.
Here's the deal. It's called DNA. DNA has not been around forever. DNA comes around, and the exonerations almost always reflect a small sliver, a test of how the system works. And that test is the following. For cases where DNA was actually captured, such as blood, semen, hair, skin, whatever it is, and then preserved, but could not have been scientifically tested at the time, we're getting a look at how the rest of the criminal justice system looked. 25 years later, after some innocent person has sat in a jail and been on death row, which is pretty dismal, for all that time, in this small sliver of cases where they took the DNA and they preserved it all this time, we find that they're innocent, and then they get out. There are so many people on death row. The vast majority on death row are there without any DNA having been collected. So what we're really seeing here is a sample of a subset, and that sample proves the inaccuracy of identifications, the untruthfulness of confessions. Look at this, for example. Of the exonerees, 30% of them confessed to a crime we absolutely know they didn't commit. Of the exonerees, 70% were positively identified by people who were just, for the most part, honestly mistaken. The exonerees are an indictment of the whole system and its inaccuracies, and they are a call to action to try to make the whole system more accurate. So that's why I say that's an extra dumb argument. It's also extra dumb because it forgets the fact that we've had generations of people before there was DNA. It kind of leaves that part out. So we've had plenty of innocent people executed. We have plenty of people on death row in Pennsylvania who don't have the benefit of having had DNA collected and preserved, who are innocent. I mean, that's just the reality. There's no other intelligent way to interpret this data.
How did what happened? I know this is not this is Arkansas, different state. But how did what happened in Arkansas happen with those executions before that lethal drug expired? That's all of that is legal technically. Like, it just seems like such a barbaric thing to allow to happen.
It is a barbaric thing. I mean, it's because you have a bunch of cynical politicians, a bunch of, frankly, medieval-minded people who are perfectly happy to kill people in order to advance their careers, who see no problem with killing the innocent now and then. You know, that's reality.
Right. What will it take for the death penalty to become illegal on a national level? Is that going to happen?
Well,
federal level?
Is it going to happen? It is going to happen. You know, it is going to happen. It's increasingly happening. What's happening is that juries are shutting it down more and more, which is a clear reflection of the popular will. What's also happening is that you're getting progressive DAs elected. For example, Aramis Ayala in Orlando came out and said, look, I have studied this. I'm not going to pursue the death penalty. And despite the onslaught from the governor of Florida and various other people, she's sticking to her guns.
Sticking to her non-guns.
There you go.
Making a pun.
All right.
Non-lethal pun.
I see what you did.
You can use it.
I see
go
what
around,
you did there.
Stump with that.
That was killer. I see what you did there.
Non-killer.
She's sticking to her guns. Well, that's my position as well. And it's going to be the position of more and more district attorneys who are in a position to say, I have the discretion to pursue the death penalty, but I won't. So anyway, it's going to happen. But as with most popular movements, it's going to happen first because people are going to say no, then because their elected officials are going to say no when they have discretion, and then because legislation is going to say no.
And what about the cruel and unusual thing? I mean, is it a numbers game to a certain extent, whether or not the death penalty is cruel and forget the cruel part, the unusual part. Is that based at all on how many states practice it?
You know, honestly, I've always found those constitutional arguments kind of goofy.
Not dumb. What was the other term? Not super dumb.
Extra super dumb.
Extra super dumb. This is like dumb, just regular dumb.
This is kind of like just dumb.
Dumb, yeah, low-key dumb.
It's capital D, though.
Capital D.
Yeah.
What can people do to find out more about your campaign and to support you moving forward?
Well, I'm glad you asked. They can go to krasner4da.com, which is krasnerforda.com, and they can volunteer in a variety of ways. As you know, in the world of distributed efforts, there's all sorts of things that can be done. I mean, there were people who were doing things for me in different states, even in different countries.
And that was Larry Krasner, the Democratic nominee for District Attorney of Philadelphia at the People's Summit in Chicago. I'm really excited to be talking to Paula Jean Swearengin. That is, the last name is spelled, just so people who want to look her up can do so. It's Swearengin. And Paula is a brand new Congress candidate, and she's running against Joe Manchin. So can you tell us about how you got involved in this race and about what Brand New Congress is?
Well, I'm with Brand New Congress and Justice Democrats, and I'm running against Senator Joe Manchin in West Virginia. Several reasons that I got involved was because I had been an activist for several years fighting for clean water, clean air, and a stable economic infrastructure in West Virginia. I'm a coal miner's daughter and granddaughter. Most of my family worked in the industry. I've dealt with the progression and regression of coal. I've tasted polluted water. I've seen some of the cleanest water in the world that no longer exists. I've buried a lot of my family to the coal industry. My daddy died at 54 years old. My grandpa, he suffocated to death with black lung. Most of my uncles have black lung. And my stepdad, he has heart disease. So being a friend of coal, I found out coal wasn't a friend of mine. Lately there's a divide in West Virginia, and the divide stems from propaganda that coal is our big promise. We fought for generations with coal. We've dealt with the boom and bust. Our ancestors fought labor struggles and won. This generation's kind of failed. We failed each other because we've been bid against each other for basic human rights, and that's food and water. But I decided to run because after all my years of begging, pleading, and crying, I felt like it went to deaf ears. And our politicians are not people serving. They're self-serving and they're industry serving. Brand New Congress has been a great deal of support to me in West Virginia because they're helping with my campaign. We are running a slate of candidates all over America that feel like I do, that ordinary people should be making decisions in their government instead of corporate money. And I'm happy that we have that kind of support because we have not had no hope and promise for a long time. And I'm glad to have comrades all over America, colleagues all over America, wanting to do the same thing as me. Ordinary people, teachers, economists, I'm a single mom in Appalachia. I'm an accounting clerk. I never thought that I would be running for Senate, but I think that we need real decision makers and for us, and we need to be making decisions for ourselves. The Industrial Revolution was built on the backs of coal miners, their families, and surrounding communities. This nation has been powered by our blood. Trillions of dollars in coal has went out of West Virginia. We've not seen no return in our communities. We're one of the sickest and poorest states in the nation. I'm ready to fight for a future for my children. I'm ready to fight back. West Virginia is ready to fight back, and we're uniting like we have never united before.
Black lung, I didn't know this, and I don't want to be gruesome, but I also think it's important for people to know, it's not just a lethal disease, but it involves a lot of suffering.
Yeah. My grandpa, he was a union man, and he had a really cushy retirement, but he lived suffocating until he died. He lived on oxygen, breathing machines. He coughed up black coal dust. It hardens your dust. It hardens your lungs. We also have silicosis in West Virginia. We have a method of coal mining called mountaintop removal coal mining. And the dust from that form of mining can travel 5 miles. And it's silica dust and the components from that. And that's going in our children's lungs now. And, you know, they've tried to take away the regulations for the underground mines and the safety regulations. So this generation is not being protected like my grandfather was and like my daddy was, even though they did suffer like they did. And I don't know if you know, Joe Manchin fought for the Miners Protection Act. What happened was we had some of the coal industries in West Virginia file bankruptcy. They were continuing to go on with business. So the retirees with the UMWA have been at risk of losing their health care and their pensions, which nobody's been really fighting for their pensions yet. But they were promised this. They were promised this lifetime benefit for their sacrifices, and they were going to lose it. It was an attack on our elderly. They did get, through the Reclaim Act, they did get their health care, which is coming out of our tax dollars. The industry has not been held accountable. But there's no promise for future coal miners. And also, I want it to resonate that these companies are still allowed to make a profit after they were bailed out of their responsibility. So it's kind of smoke and mirrors. And it's re-election time. And so what happens in West Virginia is it seems like our politicians seem to notice and they seem to fight, but they don't fight for our issues the rest of the time. In this during this administration, they've gotten rid of the streamline protection rule in West Virginia, the tank bill, which was protecting some of our water quality. And even with the Clean Water Act, we're not protected because the coal industry kind of gets a fine like a parking ticket, but they're not held responsible.
Well, and also, even, don't they make more money? Isn't it cheaper for them to cut corners and save money and pay the fine than it would be for them to not cut the corners? In other words, whatever they're getting fined for, it's such a low amount compared to all the money that they're saving by not doing this health and safety thing.
Right. And public health and safety is last on the political platform. And why should that even be? Coal miners even deserve clean water. But what we've seen now with the market, coal mining is not going to rebound. And in the panhandle, they've got fracking now. So those people are starting to deal with a singular industry-based economy. They're having to deal with water issues. But there's really no plan B in the southern coal fields, except for possibly gas, is what Joe Manchin told me the last time I saw him. But they're not investing in any kind of economic development that's going to take care of the environment and is going to give a kickback in our communities. We deserve a diverse economy. Like I said, trillions of dollars went out of state in coal. My platform now is to put that trillions of dollars back in our state and back in our communities and give educational opportunities. And everybody in West Virginia deserves health care. What does it say about America? We have some of the sickest people in the world. You know, you turn on your light switch, it's powered by the blood of Appalachians. Everybody in Appalachia deserves equal health care.
What is the future of jobs in Appalachia? Where are people going to be finding employment if coal is not the future?
We've already experienced depopulation. It's time to bring our families back home. But, you know, there's something about our culture in West Virginia. You know, the mountains are like magnets to us. That's our home. You know, my family settled there when the Cherokee Indians did. I'm part Scots-Irish and part Cherokee. My family settled there before the coal industry did, and they're wore out their welcome because it's not helping us anymore. And when did it ever help us? You know, look at all of our labor struggles and look at the environmental impact. And we're the headwaters to the eastern seaboard, so we're not being good neighbors either. But yeah, even outside the environmental impact, there's no promise whatsoever, and there's no diversity in our economy. We can have wind and solar in West Virginia, and we can manufacture wind and solar in West Virginia. We can grow hemp on the mountaintop removal sites. They're not fit for a rattlesnake, but it's been proven the hemp is invasive. It can grow there. So that's at least something that we could do with the damage that's been done. And just like with the Miners Protection Act, that was like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. Our leaders do not go to the root of the source. Anything the coal industry wants, they get. And there's a clear difference between being a friend of the coal industry and a friend of the coal miners. The current miners have no protections whatsoever. And it's a shame that they're treating our workforce like that. And most of the people in the communities in West Virginia and the southern coal fields, they are connected one way or the other to the coal industry. I'm a coal miner's daughter. And how dare Senator Joe Manchin sit there and tell me I have to give up my water supply and my children have to give up a water supply because my neighbors and my family and my friends need jobs. We are a family, we are neighbors, and we are friends. It's wrong to say we should be divided. We all deserve clean and safe jobs. And the last time I talked to him and approached him and told him that we deserve that, He was trying to bid the coal miners in the crowd against me and said we would have to agree to disagree. That's a disgrace. He's a public servant, and he's sitting there telling the people in Appalachia that we don't deserve. We're human beings. We live in a sacrifice zone, and we are tired of being their collateral damage.
Why isn't he? Yeah, I mean, does he have to drink the water? Is he drinking the water that's being polluted from the coal mining?
You know what? I invite him to take a drink. He is welcome to take a drink anytime.
And what? How did you see him? You were at some kind of forum, or
he held town halls because he's up for re-election.
Right. When did you always feel this way about him? Did your opinion of him change?
I think years ago, I voted for him one time, but I think it's just like a surgeon. You can get immune to people suffering and people dying. You know, now people say to him, we are dying. We are actually dying at an alarming rate. High levels of cancer. We have cancer clusters in Appalachia. Silicosis is coming to our children if we don't do something about mountaintop removal and regulate it better. And he does not care. I don't, his funders is why he doesn't care. They make decisions for him, make decisions for us. It's a disgrace that you have to fight over basic human rights.
Right.
And that's not our fault. That's our government's fault.
Right. And there's no need to, because no one wants to be, we don't need to be poisoning one group or the other, one group so that another group can make money. I mean, your neighbors, right? So if the group that makes money is having to drink poison water, what good is that, right? If you're not alive, you can't enjoy your salary.
And people become complacent because they feel like they can't do anything because the government's so big and the coal industry's so big. But, you know, that's what this is about, is ordinary people saying, you know what, there's more people in America than they are in our government, and we can fight back, and we can fight back with our votes. You know, this campaign is launched in a month. And with brand new Congress, we are not a federal PAC, we're a super PAC. We are taking monies from individuals. It's people funded. We're not even allowed to take over $5,000 in an individual donation from a person. And so you think about that within a month, $80,000. That just shows right there that people can invest in their own government. And I don't need billions of dollars in this campaign. I need votes. Votes. We have to vote them out. People need to get up off the couch and run for office and take their government back, because it should not be allowed. It's genocide. And they tell us that we're not worthy. We are worthy, and we need to fight back.
What was it like when you heard Sanders come? This guy was a thick New York accent who talks like this. I've got emotional when I watched that. There was something very endearing about watching the connection between him and people. Who came from such different walks of life, but it doesn't matter.
Senator Sanders, I had somebody ask me when he was coming up to West Virginia, when he rallied, it amazed me because he was talking about issues. He was the first politician outside of our state and in our state. He paid more attention, and when he was rallying, he was talking about Mount McDowell County, and he was talking about these points that nobody was even recognizing, not even the media. And then when he came back for that town hall, I wasn't even thinking about running for office then.
I remember you. Yeah.
I went to him crying because he felt like hope, because he was there. He was caring. And I didn't even know we was being recorded. I just felt like I was crying to Grandpa.
Right. Now I remember. I was like, why do you look familiar? And I remember you were the woman afterwards who was crying. Yeah.
Yeah. And that I was just doing what I'd done, begging for anybody to pay attention to us. And Jim Justice, one of the biggest polluting coal barons in West Virginia, I was just wrapping my head around all that stuff then, and he is my Democratic governor, and he's putting silica dust in my kids' lungs every day 3 miles from my house from his mountaintop removal sites. And after that, people were like, run, Paula, you should run. And I realized that there was this huge movement that I wasn't even aware of. And people were willing to help West Virginia. And it just empowered me enough that it gave me enough courage to say, you know what, Joe Manchin is no better than me. How dare him allow this to happen to our children? How dare him say that we're collateral damage, jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, by God, we'll bring jobs and we'll fire you.
So wait a second. So you decided to run for to against Joe Manchin after the Bernie Sanders town
hall? Ma'am.
So can you tell us what happened? What I'm glad now I realize. I mean, this is very exciting for me. Not to, I was already, I thought you were really cool, like, already, but now I'm like, oh my God, it's a woman from. So tell me what you thought and felt when you heard him, and then how you approached him, like, physically. How did you reach him? Was he surrounded by people? And then what you guys said to each other.
Well, it seemed like the big greens last summer were saying coal was over, and it wasn't. We have an election idle. The market's been down, but I kind of felt deserted to a point. And I was writing op-eds and writing MSNBC, CNN, and so Diane Sheamus is with the Chris Haynes Show.
Yeah, yeah. Chris Haynes, yeah, yeah.
Had contacted me, and she said, your story touched me. This is about McDowell County, but we would like to get you on the show if we could fit you in. They couldn't fit me in. When the show was over, I kind of run into the crowd and was trying to bird dog him because I thought, you know, he cares so much, maybe he can do something.
What's bird dog? I don't know
yeah,
that term.
We call it bird dogging when we chase politicians to try to get their attention.
Nice.
So, yeah, I went and I walked up to him and he was so sweet. I said, Senator Sanders, can you give me at least 2 minutes of your time? And he said, yeah. So I kind of followed him around like a puppy. And I tell you, watch it, you know, you watch politicians and senators and they're overwhelmed with the media, and he was talking to the media and stopping for 1,000 pictures, and we even walked up to another media outlet and he just stopped. He said, no, I promised her 2 minutes, and he just took me to the side just to talk to me like a human being. And he didn't overpromise, because what can he do? But, you know, sure. A whole lot for West Virginia. We don't have support from our leadership. He has been there, and he's brought issues, and I know he would do anything he could for us. But you know what? Sometimes you got to do things for yourself. You
so
know.
What did you say to him? What did he say to you?
I pretty much cried and told him what was going on, and he said, "I'm not going to overpromise." And he hugged me, and yeah, and his staff contacted me like he promised and asked what they could do, and you know they've been very helpful, but. He's not. There's not a whole lot he can do being one person,
right?
You know, and then we have to build a movement. Like you know, he started that engine, and that made me realize. Save Main Street came up, Stan Annabelle Park and Stan Williams right after that to help us. And I had, you know, people were like, run, Paula, run. And it never even went in my mind to that moment. And I was so grateful for them because they were showing that West Virginia was still struggling. Because what happens with the media is there's light on Appalachia. Then they're showing Flint. Then they're showing Standing Rock. But there's never no united effort. And I've been saying for years, we need to unite about groundwater. We need to unite. We need to unite. And then I found out there was this whole huge movement, and we were uniting, and people were taking their government back. And I'm like, hell yeah, sign me up.
And that's Save Main Street?
This was Brand New Congress after that.
Because
that's when, you know, other people started contacting me. And I don't know who nominated me, but I got two nominations out of Appalachia after that.
After that town hall.
Well, after Save Main Street,
okay,
too,
so
and everything.
So Save Main Street, you went to an event that they did?
Okay. They actually came up to one of the organizations in West Virginia, and a bunch of us showed them Mountaintop Removal. I took them out and showed them, you know, polluted water, and they got a lot of video. They done a lot of live streams. They talked to people, talked to me, and they just raised the voices and the issues of Appalachia. It was beautiful because we hadn't had that kind of coverage in a long time.
And that was Paula Swearinger at the People's Summit in Chicago, and she's running against Joe Manchin to represent West Virginia in the U.S. Senate. So excited to be talking to Ginger Jensen, who is running for Minneapolis City Council, Ward 3. All New Yorkers I know are crazy about Ward 3. We love it. It's the best. And Ginger is here, and she is committed to, she's committed to building a grassroots movement for a $15 an hour minimum wage, taxing the rich, funding affordable housing, mass transit, and healthcare programs, strengthening tenants' rights, and ending the undemocratic state preemption on rent control, resisting the Trump agenda through no deportations, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ rights. And she's also part of Socialist Alternative. Cool. We're so excited to have you on the Katie Halper Show. It's the debut. Katie Halper. Things are really, this is a real important milestone. Things are going to change.
That's excellent.
And you're going to waltz into that city council seat. Can you tell us a little bit about why you're running and what you are hoping to achieve through your campaign?
Sure. Well, thanks so much for talking with me today. I mean, over the last 3 years, I have been the executive director for 15 now. And that was a, you know, it's a broad movement campaign that was launched out of Seattle in 2014. And with Shama Sawant helped to raise the minimum wage there to be the first major city to go with that $15 minimum wage. And in Minneapolis, you know, over the last, in 2016, actually, we collected signatures to try and put $15 minimum wage on the ballot to voters. And it had majority support in the city, over 68%. You know, they wanted to do it without a tip penalty, which Minnesota is one of only seven states where tip workers get the same minimum wage as any other minimum wage worker. It's a super important thing to protect. And basically, the city council, entirely Democratic Party, with the exception of one Green Party member, knocked it off the ballot. And so we sued the city with a group of low-wage workers. We won in a lower court. But then again, the city appealed to basically keep workers in poverty. And we lost at the Minnesota Supreme Court. But through the process of that grassroots campaign, where we gathered nearly 20,000 signatures just, you know, in the city of Minneapolis, made it a key issue in the 2017 elections this year. And basically, we've put it at the center of politics in Minneapolis. And now I'm actually really proud to say that we're on the verge of victory, and we're on the verge of winning a minimum wage of $15 in the city of Minneapolis. The city council slated a vote on it at the end of June. And this would affect over 71,000 workers, you know, predominantly women and workers of color who are disproportionately in low-wage jobs. And it was basically the experience that I've had running up against the Democratic Party, putting hurdle after hurdle in front of low-wage workers trying to assert their interests in the city of Minneapolis, you know, supposedly a very progressive city. And basically, that's a lot of the background for why I wanted to run with Socialist Alternative. I'm a member of the organization. And basically, I think we can do what Seattle has done and use that model to, you know, sort of put forward a really workers' rights-oriented, you know, the interests of working people at the forefront of the stage in Minneapolis. I was a tipped worker myself for around a decade and have done a lot of work, you know, with people in Minneapolis around tenants' rights issues. And I worked with Occupy Homes in the past to resist foreclosures. It's basically, I think, about asserting a real agenda for working people and having our movements with an organizing seat in City Hall.
What was the justification given by Democrats who voted against the $15 an hour minimum wage bill?
I think, like in a lot of places across the country, they were basically pointing to process. They were saying that a citizen-led initiative, or, you know, a workers' rights initiative that would go to voters, they didn't want laws to be decided in that way. They thought it was
too democratic,
basically. They wanted to have control over the process. And that was where, I mean, I think that was a very polarizing part of the process, where they were basically saying, we want to lead, but in actuality, they didn't want to do anything. And it's really been under the pressure of a massive grassroots movement where we've had meetings and protests and demonstrations. There's been fast food strikes. You know, it's, I think, really exciting actually to connect too with recently UFCW workers have been organizing at co-ops in the city of Minneapolis, and they're about to have their union recognized. And the workers who are working at these co-ops first came to the movement through the 15 Now movement. So a broad grassroots movement actually has led to more discussion about the need to have, you know, long-term bargaining power, long-term representation. And that's part of why I think it's really important we do these even broader campaigns at the municipal level, because it points in the direction of what workers really need. In this case, that's a bridging into actual union representation.
And what is Socialist Alternative?
Yeah, so we're a national organization. We're a social, racial, gender justice, economic justice organization. And we, of course, have Shama Sawant as a representative on the Seattle City Council. And I think a lot of what she's been able to do with her office as a megaphone for social movements is what we aim to do in Minneapolis with my campaign. In one example, there was a proposal in Seattle to spend $160 million to build a new police precinct. Now, mind you, the Seattle Police Department has been under investigation for the last several years, federal investigation, for too many instances of aggression and
so
police brutality.
To pay their legal costs.
Yeah, potentially. Fund. Yeah, they've got to figure out how to best, you know, sort of make up that debt. But Shama was able to organize with this Block the Bunker coalition of, you know, anti-racist organizations, Black Lives Matter, and young people who are trying to resist this bunker from being built. And they were successful in not only blocking that $160 million, but with the housing crisis in Seattle, they were able to get $30 million put toward building below market rate, affordable housing. That is the type of stuff with putting positive proposals forward for what people really need, connecting the idea that, like, in actuality, it's not about further burdening regular working people, but we have to talk about taxing the rich. There's no way to talk about what people actually need in cities or resisting the Trump agenda without talking about the need to further tax the rich.
Right. And that's something that people don't really remember. You know, we constantly hear the idea or the phrase thrown around, we can't afford it. Where's the money going to come from? Money doesn't grow on trees. No, it doesn't grow on trees, but it can come from taxing the rich, right?
Absolutely.
And that was Ginger Jensen, Minneapolis City Council Ward 3 candidate at the People's Summit in Chicago. I'm really excited to be talking to Stephen Jaffe, who is running for Congress for the 12th District of California. And that means that he is running to unseat Nancy Pelosi. That, welcome.
That is correct. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for talking to us. Can you tell us, please, what made you decide to run?
Well, my decision to run really came in three steps. First, what started it all was I was tremendously inspired by Bernie Sanders as a person and also on the issues. He had really resonated within me. I worked very hard for him, sent him a lot of money. And I was actually recruited by the national campaign and went to Nevada to help supervise what turned out to be chaotic Nevada caucuses. But so that was the first thing that, got me thinking on a larger scale. The next thing that happened was in July when Bernie was essentially cheated and screwed out of the nomination. That offended me politically, personally, and as a lawyer, I found the process that was followed very offensive, and I'm upset, continue to be, that there's no remedy for people that, do that.
So
for Bernie.
What can you elaborate on that as a lawyer, as a jurist, if you will? Lots of people talk about him being cheated, but it's kind of hard to, make the case, I think. It's hard to find people who make the case kind of convincingly, but also in an intelligible way. So can you explain it?
I think you're asking me, what do I mean by being cheated?
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of the primary votes and caucus results were manipulated to give Hillary delegates that she really didn't win. I know that I personally witnessed with my eyeballs real bad stuff going on in Nevada. So when Hillary defenders say, oh, we didn't do that, it was never proved, you know, it was proved to me because I saw it.
Like what kind of stuff?
Well, the caucuses were run in various public buildings. Schools were common. There was one I know where it was held in a school. There was actually five precincts were caucusing in five different classrooms of that school. Each caucus was supposed to have a caucus leader appointed to be there and run the caucus in a fair manner. And then each real estate site for that school was supposed to have a site director to cover the activities of the entire site. Well, the one school I'm talking about, none of the caucus directors showed up, so they were chaotic, and a lot of people, they had to essentially, the caucus, elect on the spot a leader, and the stories I heard from people is that the Hillary people bullied all of the caucuses into making their people the leaders, even though they may have been outnumbered. The site director situation in that particular location, the site director was a 17-year-old high school girl who was clueless about what to do and how to do it. Wasn't her fault.
Right.
She really wasn't equipped to take on that kind of job or responsibility. There were people standing in line when the caucus's doors were closed who were told, go home, you won't get in. That violated the law. They were entitled. They're in line. They were supposed to get in. There were people told that their caucus had been moved and it was happening somewhere else. That was not true.
Did you throw the chair? Were you the famous chair thrower?
I did not throw a chair.
Well, of course, I'm referring to the footage of a man who lifted up a chair in frustration who was never identified as either a Hillary or a Bernie supporter, who was surrounded by a bunch of people who looked like Bernie supporters, who made him put the chair down and then hugged him. It was kind of a kumbaya moment. And that became the narrative of violent Bernie bros who were throwing chairs, and multiple outlets reported about chairs being thrown. So what is your background? You practice law?
I've been a lawyer for 46 years. I practice employment law for employees only.
Oh, good. So the good guys.
Yes, I'm one of the good guys in the white hats. I do protected class-based discrimination, age, race, gender, disability, nationality. Everybody knows the list.
Right.
Marital status, sexual orientation.
Right.
And I've done them all.
So it's funny. I went to college with someone who I saw a couple years after we graduated, and after she'd graduated from law school. So I guess like 5 years, 10 years, 7 years, whatever. That doesn't matter. Point is, I ran into her years after college. She told me she was doing employment law. I said, "Oh, and the good side or the bad side?" She said, "There is no good side or bad side." I was like, "Oh, so the bad side."
Because
no one would ever say if they were on the good side that there's no good side or bad side.
I do what I do for two reasons. One, I'm just not wired to represent management. That's not who I am. But secondly, when you represent individuals, you make a difference in their lives. You change their lives. When you represent corporations, they don't know who you are.
True.
So it's much more rewarding and gratifying.
On just a personal level.
Yes, to represent people and help people because it's the right thing to do.
Right. You do change other people's lives. You just, like, you know, when you're representing the corporations, but that just means what? That you get people fired and you let people get fired.
By changing lives, I mean in a good way.
Right, exactly, yeah. And so why, what's wrong with Nancy Pelosi? She's like, you know, she doesn't like Trump. Isn't that enough?
We are in the most, I think, progressive congressional district possibly in the U.S. Nancy Pelosi does not represent her politics, her constituents. She's disconnected from the people who have been voting for her year after year because she's been essentially unopposed. That's what's wrong with Nancy Pelosi. She needs a representative in Congress should reflect the views and the wishes and the interests of his or her constituents. She doesn't do that.
So what are you going to be doing that's different?
Well, I can. I mean,
well, yeah.
We are different on many, many issues. The three that come to mind, I usually talk about. I am an absolute supporter of single payer. She is not. She refuses to co-sponsor John Conyers' bill for single payer. The reason she does that is because she takes a great deal of money from healthcare providers, insurance companies, pharmacies. And they have a strong interest in not having single payer. They would lose their profits,
right?
To a great extent. Another issue is I am a strong advocate for a drastic reform of the Democratic Party. I want to abolish superdelegates. I want to abolish automatic endorsement of incumbents. Ms. Pelosi doesn't want to reform the Democratic Party because that's how she keeps control of it.
Right.
I am a strong environment.
If it ain't broke for you, don't fix it.
Yes. I am broke a strong advocate of protecting the environment. To put it bluntly, I am against anything which harms the environment. The current hot issue button, the hot button issue, is fracking. I'm against fracking. I don't believe Ms. Pelosi has ever said she is against fracking. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So I'm much more of a progressive, left-leaning politician than she is.
What about, sorry, I just, single payer. How are you, how much has Bernie Sanders inspired you? And also, how do we make sure that people stay focused and talk about issues and not just personalities?
Well, Bernie inspired me because as a person, I was inspired by, first of all, he's an old guy like me, and that was inspiring.
Not old. You don't see our guest right now, Mr. Jaffe, but he's actually wearing a halter, spandex, and is lifting weights right as we speak.
Yes. Well, okay, folks, if you believe that, I have a red bridge out in the Bay Area
exactly,
I can sell you. But
no corduroy jacket.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I really like Bernie as a person. I like the way he talks, the straightforward way he talks, and the way that he is, I think, indisputably the most honest politician out there. And I strive to emulate him in that way. I also agree with almost 100% of his position on issues.
Right.
So I would say that I've been greatly influenced by him. I want to tell him where my website is.
Yes, please.
Because it's Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E, the number 4, congress.com.
Great, yeah. Thank you. And again, that's Stephen R. Jaffe, Stephen Jaffe for California, for the 12th District. And that was Stephen R. Jaffe at the People's Summit in Chicago. So excited to be talking to Andre Vasquez, mm-hmm. who is with Reclaim Chicago.
Correct.
So, Andre, can you please tell us what Reclaim Chicago is dedicated to and what it's
so
all
Reclaim
about?
Reclaim Chicago is it's a group that was formed by the National Nurses United and the People's Lobby, so C3 and C4. And what we are focused on is really transforming local government politics and focusing a lot on electoral work. So we do direct actions, but we also work to build bases that are very localized and as well as try to find candidates. So we build like a candidate pipeline. So I met Reclaim Chicago because before that I was a rapper with a retail job. And
me too.
Yes.
Just
everybody gets in.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got a retail job. I ended up doing marketing at where I worked. And, I've got two kids, a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old, my wife. We suddenly get a lot more serious about doing anything we can to improve Chicago and just in general. Bernie, I wouldn't say come out of nowhere. We had been paying attention to Bernie, but I was cynical that people would understand the message because usually presidential elections are somewhat beauty pageants. But we started seeing him get momentum. I started blasting my Facebook and letting people hear know about Bernie, and was invited to meet him on the south side of Chicago by a friend of mine who happened to be the sister of Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa. He is an alderman in our city council. He is 28, I believe now. Democratic socialist. I'm proud of it. Openly gay Latino, like ran for office and won with 67% of the vote as a movement candidate. So yeah, so that along with helping also Kim Fox, helping out the campaigns. So our state's attorney for
Illinois. Okay.
Yeah. So just really focusing on a lot of progressive politics. So I said I was invited to meet Bernie. That made me decide to find 3 strangers on Facebook and go to Iowa and knock on doors before the primary. Then came back to town, decided I was going to put together a show. Like I'd done hip hop shows before. I wanted to bring in people who typically weren't a part of the process. So we brought in that crowd, also met a lot of community organizations through that and kind of smooshed it together in an event called Burn Fest. That was the night before the primaries in Illinois.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It was a night before the primaries in Illinois. And we did great. It sold out at about 350 people. And I met Amanda Weaver, who's the executive director at Reclaim Chicago. And she asked me what I was doing next, and I didn't have a plan. And then she basically, she said, you may not know what you're doing or what you call it, but you're community organizing, whether you know it or not.
Wow.
Then I formally trained through Reclaim. And since then, led marches. I was part at the People's Action Rise Up, the People's Action Founding Convention. I was on stage with Bernie to announce that I'll be running for office in 2 to 5 years. We stormed the Heritage Foundation. We were protesting outside of the White House. So it's really been a roller coaster ever since. And it's been amazing.
Wow.
And I was definitely angry after the primaries. I think a lot of us were. And I chose to kind of direct that energy towards being productive. And it's kind of taken me here.
So. Right. Do you still rap? Are you still?
No. I mean, that was feels like years ago, right? So when I was a rapper, I was a battle rapper in the city, and I was on HBO's Blaze Battle, was the first televised MC battle, as well as MTV's DFX.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, not anymore. Now I've got kids. I'm a family man. So
you could. What about doing family rap?
I try not to.
Yeah, you could do child friendly rap.
Yeah, we do like kids books in rap form.
Oh my, that would be really good.
Actually, probably would resonate.
Right? Anything else you want to make sure?
No, I would say just check out reclaimchicago.org. I also have an organization called chicagoprogress.com.
Oh, what's that?
We're trying to work on developing media and content. So the same way like you're doing the show here, podcast, the way the Young Turks has a show, like doing the same thing but hyper focused on local.
Oh, great.
Right? Like everyone should bring in their aldermen, their county people, and teach people about local government through like 2-minute videos on Facebook.
Where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, so you could look up Andre Vasquez on Twitter. It's Andre Vasquez, AndreVasquezCP.
Communist Party?
Thanks. Yeah. Chicago Progress.
Okay.
It was low-key. No.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you check out Chicago Progress on Facebook, I'm on Facebook pretty heavy. So once you do that, I'll be able to find you.
Great.
If people don't find
Instagram
me.
Too?
Yeah.
All right, awesome. Thank you so much, Andre Vasquez of Reclaim Chicago
Thank you, Katie.
Chicago Progress.
Yep.
Thanks. Make sure you go to patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show because I'll be posting parts of the interviews that I'm not including in this episode. Thanks.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.